right. So you've cracked open, speak out, call in, and you're diving into this chapter all about audiences.
Public speaking.
Public speaking, yeah.
It's more than just you up there talking, right?
Right.
This chapter really drives home how crucial understanding your audience is for crafting a message that lands, for advocating effectively.
Totally. And it's interesting because the chapter talks about different layers of audience. There's the obvious one, the folks right there in the room, whether it's a lecture hall or a Zoom meeting. The book calls this the explicit audience.
Right, but the idea of audience goes deeper than that.
Okay.
There's also the implied audience or implicated audience. These are the groups your message is about or affects, even if they're not physically present.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Give me an example.
Let's say you're giving a speech advocating for more accessible public transportation. Your explicit audience might be your classmates, but your implied audience includes people with disabilities who rely on public transit. They're implicated in your message, even if they're not in the room.
That makes total sense.
Issue.
You're speaking to your classmates, but for those who would benefit from better accessibility.
Exactly.
That raises a question for
You
me.
sure?
How do you figure out what your audience needs or wants from your speech?
Well, the chapter talks about information gathering,
Okay.
which sounds a little like detective work, but it's key.
Yeah.
You need to understand your audience's motivations,
Right.
what matters to them, what are their concerns, what are they lacking that your speech could help fulfill. Think of it this way: you're not just delivering information,
Yeah.
you're trying to meet a need.
So it's about understanding the why behind their presence. Like, what brings them to your speech in the first place? Is it a mandatory class, a professional development workshop, a community forum? Knowing that why helps you tailor your message.
Precisely. The chapter even brings up Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Remember that pyramid?
Vaguely, it's one of those things you learn and then promptly forget until it pops up again, right?
Yeah.
Refresh my memory.
Sure. Maslow's hierarchy is a psychological theory that categorizes human needs into a pyramid.
Okay.
At the bottom are basic physiological needs like food, water, and shelter.
Okay.
Then it moves up to safety and security,
Right.
belonging and love, esteem, and finally at the very top, self-actualization.
Okay. I remember that now.
Okay.
So how does that relate to public speaking?
Well, by figuring out where your topic fits into this hierarchy, you can get a sense of what your audience might be seeking
Okay.
or what needs they're hoping to address.
So if I'm giving a speech about financial literacy to a group of college students, I might tap into their need for security and stability, right?
Ironically.
But if I'm talking about the importance of creative expression,
Yeah.
that might speak more to their need for self-actualization.
Exactly. And understanding these needs helps you frame your message in a way that resonates with your audience
Okay.
and motivates them to listen. The book also points out that the context of your speech plays a huge role.
What do they mean by context specifically?
It's about recognizing the setting and the occasion. Is it a formal presentation at a conference, a casual talk at a community center, a passionate plea at a protest?
Right.
Each situation comes with different expectations and norms.
Right.
Knowing those helps you adapt your approach.
Okay.
For example, you wouldn't use the same tone and style for a eulogy as you would for a stand-up comedy routine.
That's so true. You've got to read the room, so to speak.
Yeah.
But how much should you rely on demographics when analyzing an audience? Things like age, occupation, religion, and so on.
It's tricky. The chapter warns against falling into the trap of stereotypes.
Right.
Just because a few people in a group share a trait doesn't mean everyone does.
Right, like assuming that all senior citizens are technologically challenged or all millennials are glued to their phones.
Exactly. The book calls this overgeneralization essentializing, reducing a complex group of individuals down to a single, often inaccurate characteristic.
Gotcha.
And it can be deeply offensive and ultimately ineffective.
So demographics can be helpful clues, but you've got to use them thoughtfully and ethically.
Absolutely.
Avoid those sweeping generalizations that can alienate your audience.
Absolutely. Instead of relying on stereotypes, the chapter suggests focusing on uncovering your audience's beliefs, attitudes, and values.
Okay.
These are much deeper and more nuanced than surface-level demographics.
Okay, let's dig into those. What exactly do they mean by beliefs, attitudes, and values?
Okay.
And how can a speaker even begin to understand those things about their audience?
Well, beliefs are essentially the things we hold to be true about the world.
Okay.
They might not actually be true, but they shape how we interpret information and make decisions.
Right.
Values represent what we consider important and desirable,
Okay.
our guiding principles. And attitudes are our positive or negative evaluations of things, often influenced by our beliefs and values. It's a bit like an intricate web, isn't it? Beliefs, values, and attitudes all interconnected, influencing how we see the world and respond to messages.
Yeah, it's complex.
Yeah.
But if you can tap into those deeper layers, you can craft a speech that really connects.
Right.
But how do you actually figure out those beliefs, values, and attitudes, especially if you don't know your audience personally? Do you just send out a survey beforehand?
Huh, that's one way, but it's not always practical.
Right.
The book emphasizes doing your research.
Okay.
If you're speaking to a specific group, like a professional organization or a community club, look into their mission statement, read their publications, browse their website, and don't underestimate the power of observation.
Okay.
Pay attention to how your audience members interact with each other,
right.
What they wear, what they bring up in conversations.
Right.
These can all offer subtle clues about their underlying beliefs and values.
So it's about being a bit of an anthropologist, studying the culture of your audience. That makes sense.
And remember, even within a single group, you'll have a diversity of opinions and perspectives.
Right.
Avoid making assumptions about an entire audience based on a few vocal individuals.
Gotcha.
The chapter also reminds us that we don't just speak to an audience.
Right.
We often speak for them, especially when it comes to those implied or implicated audiences.
That's where things get really interesting, ethically speaking.
Yes.
Because how you represent a group, especially one that's not present, can have real-world consequences.
Mm-hmm.
The book gave that example about the speech advocating for military intervention.
Right.
And the speaker used the term barbaric to describe another country.
Yes. And that kind of language can be so dangerous. It plays into ethnocentrism, the belief that your own culture is superior to others.
Right. And it dehumanizes the people you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It can lead to prejudice and even violence.
Yeah.
It's a reminder that words have power. And we have a responsibility to use them carefully, especially when speaking on behalf of others.
It's not just about being politically correct. It's about being accurate and respectful.
Right.
It's about doing your due diligence to understand the group you're representing and making sure your words don't perpetuate harmful stereotypes or biases.
Right.
And of course, if you're using ideas from another person or group,
right.
even if they're not present, always give them credit.
Yeah, give them credit.
That's where citations and a solid bibliography come in.
Makes sense. Plagiarism is a big no-no, whether it's intentional or not.
Right.
It's all about ethical and responsible communication.
Yes.
Okay, so we've talked about speaking to an audience and speaking for them.
Mm-hmm.
But what about the flip side? What does it mean to be a good listener?
Right.
The chapter emphasizes that listening is just as important as speaking, if not more so.
Absolutely. Listening isn't just about passively absorbing sound waves.
Right.
It's an active process that requires focus, energy, and a genuine desire to understand.
So it's not just about hearing. It's about understanding, processing, and responding. Right.
Yes. And the chapter points out that there are different types of listening we engage in depending on the situation.
Like what? Tell me more. I'm all ears.
Well, there's empathetic listening where you're focused on understanding the speaker's emotions and perspectives.
Okay.
It's about putting yourself in their shoes and trying to see the world from their point of view.
Yeah.
This is particularly important in personal relationships where we're trying to build trust and connection.
It's about feeling with them, not just for them.
Mm-hmm.
What other types of listening are there?
There's also appreciative listening, where the focus is on enjoyment and pleasure.
Okay.
Like when you're listening to your favorite music, watching a captivating movie, or even just enjoying the sounds of nature.
So it's about being fully present in the moment and savoring the experience.
Yes.
That's a good one.
And then there's critical listening, which is particularly relevant when we're listening to persuasive speeches or arguments. This type of listening requires us to evaluate the speaker's logic, evidence, and reasoning.
Okay.
It's about being discerning and forming our own judgments about the message.
So it's about engaging our brains, analyzing what's being said, and not just taking everything at face value.
Exactly.
It's almost like being a detective again.
Exactly. It's about asking questions like, does this make sense? Is this evidence credible? Are there any logical fallacies in the argument?
But let's be honest, listening can be tough.
Yeah.
our brains are wired to wander, and there's so many distractions in our modern world. The chapter mentions a few barriers to effective listening.
Yes.
Let's break those down, shall we?
Sounds good.
Well, first there's noise, which can be both external and internal.
Yes.
Right? Like the literal noise of traffic or construction or the mental chatter inside our own heads.
Right.
It's like trying to have a conversation in a crowded room where everyone's talking at once.
Exactly.
You can hear the voices but can't make out what anyone is saying.
Right.
And then there's that sneaky confirmation bias.
Yes.
Which the chapter describes as the tendency to only listen to information that confirms our existing beliefs.
It's like wearing those noise-canceling headphones, but for ideas.
We block out anything that challenges our worldview.
Right.
It's no wonder people end up in echo chambers online, only interacting with those who agree with them. And finally, there's information processing, which is about the way our brains handle information.
Right.
The chapter explains that we can actually process information much faster than most people speak, which can lead to
boredom.
Our minds start to wander and we miss crucial details.
Yeah.
It's like that feeling where you're watching a movie and someone starts explaining the plot.
Yeah.
You're like, just get on with it. I can figure it out myself.
Mm-hmm. I've definitely been there.
Okay. So we've got all these obstacles to effective listening.
Yeah.
What can we do to overcome them? The chapter offers some practical advice, right?
It does. And a lot of it comes down to being more intentional and mindful about how we listen.
Okay.
First and foremost, they emphasize practice.
Okay.
Like any skill, listening improves with repetition.
Right.
So the more we consciously focus on listening, the better we become at it.
So no more zoning out during lectures or scrolling through our phones during family dinners?
Ideally, no. The chapter also suggests being prepared to listen.
Okay.
That might involve creating a quiet environment, putting away distractions, and having a pen and paper ready to take notes.
Okay, I like that.
Surprisingly, they actually recommend pen and paper over typing.
Really? Why is that? I thought laptops were supposed to be the ultimate note-taking tool.
Apparently, there's research that shows taking notes by hand engages our brains more deeply and leads to better retention.
Interesting. It's like the physical act of writing helps us encode the information.
Exactly.
And while you're taking notes, jot down any questions that come up.
Yes.
That keeps you actively engaged with the material and helps you remember it later.
Right.
The book also points out the importance of nonverbal communication when you're in the audience.
Right, like making eye contact with the speaker.
Right.
Nodding your head and using facial expressions to show you're following along.
It's like sending a signal that says, I'm here with you. Keep going.
Exactly.
It can really boost a speaker's confidence and energy, especially if they're feeling nervous. Plus, it just makes you a more polite and engaged audience member.
Right.
It shows respect for the speaker and their message.
Right.
I really like this point the chapter makes about the constitutive nature of communication.
Oh, yeah.
It's this idea that our words actually shape the world around us.
It's profound when you think about it. The words we choose, the way we frame our messages, the stories we tell, they all contribute to creating our shared reality.
It's not just about conveying information. It's about constructing meaning, shaping perceptions, and influencing actions.
Exactly. It's like building a house, brick by brick.
Right.
Every word, every phrase contributes to the overall structure.
That makes me think about whose voices are often left out of those conversations, those whose stories aren't being told.
That's a crucial question.
Yeah.
And it ties back to our discussion about implied audiences.
Right.
The groups we don't hear from often bear the brunt of decisions made without their input.
It reminds me of that example from the book about the city council meeting where they're discussing a proposal to build a new highway.
Right. The people in the room, the council members, the developers, the lobbyists, they're all part of that explicit audience.
Right.
But the implied audience includes all the residents whose neighborhoods would be affected by the highway, even if they're not present at the meeting.
And those are the folks who often experience the negative consequences of those decisions most directly.
Exactly.
Their voices matter, but they're often silenced or overlooked.
That's why it's so important to be mindful of who's not in the room,
right,
who's not at the table,
right,
and to actively seek out those missing perspectives.
How do we do that?
It's about expanding our own information gathering, going beyond our usual sources, and being willing to listen to voices that might challenge our assumptions.
So how do we become better listeners
mm-hmm.
to those often marginalized perspectives? What are some practical steps we can take? It's like we need to tune our ears to a different frequency, one that picks up the whispers that are often drowned out by the louder voices.
It starts with recognizing our own biases, those unconscious filters that shape how we perceive the world.
Right.
We all have them.
Right.
It's part of being human, but the key is to become aware of them so they don't limit our understanding.
Right.
We can start by asking ourselves questions like, yeah. Whose voices am I not hearing? Whose stories am I missing?
And then actively seeking out those missing voices.
Exactly.
Reading books and articles by authors from different backgrounds, listening to podcasts that feature diverse perspectives, attending events where we can hear from people whose lived experiences are different from our own.
Exactly. It's about diversifying our information diet.
Right.
Expanding our circle of empathy.
And when we encounter those different perspectives, we need to listen with a genuine desire to understand.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about agreeing with everything we hear.
Right.
But it's about trying to see the world through someone else's eyes.
Exactly.
It's about replacing judgment with curiosity,
mm-hmm.
and recognizing that every person has something valuable to teach us, even if, especially if we don't agree with them.
Right.
This deep dive has been a real eye-opener for me. I feel like I've gained a whole new appreciation for the complexity of audience and the ethical dimensions of public speaking.
Me too. It's not just about delivering a polished presentation.
Right.
It's about understanding people, respecting their perspectives, and using our voices responsibly.
It's about recognizing the power of words to shape our world.
Yes.
And it's about using that power for good.
Beautifully said. And remember, whether we're preparing a speech for a large audience or just having a conversation with a friend, these principles apply. Being mindful of our audience, respecting their needs, and listening with empathy, these are the foundations of effective and ethical communication.
This has given me so much to think about. I'm curious, what is one thing our listeners can take away from this deep dive and apply to their own lives, whether they're public speaking or just navigating their everyday interactions?
I'd say pay attention to the silences.
The silences.
Who's not being heard in a particular conversation or situation? Whose perspectives are missing?
Okay.
And what can you do to amplify those voices? It might be as simple as asking a question,
right.
Sharing an article, or inviting someone new into the conversation.
That's a powerful challenge. Thanks for this incredible deep dive. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
The pleasure was all mine.